So for that case, you know, forgive him.
Yes, and sometimes, some other times, you are really in a bad mood or you are in a bad temper, then something happens to you, you say something you really don't mean it, but then just after some moments, perhaps some seconds, you feel that you've done something wrong and then you... Yeah. Ask the pardon of that person.
Okay, see, now we've narrowed this discussion down.
God is very forgivable.
God is forgiving, but
He's
people
merciful.
Aren't.
Okay, then you ask their mercy.
Yeah, okay, look, Allah is such, right, that there's a hadith that says that one who commits a sin, and then that very moment they repent,
yes,
it's as if they never committed that sin
okay,
at all,
that,
right?
That's
okay. So, you know...
That's what
and
I'm talking
by
about.
Repentance, it actually specifies that they become, you know... very, very embarrassed by that sin, and then they don't do it again, right? That
yes.
that is forgiven almost
you should
actually
pay for it.
Okay, but then when you do that to a person, that person might not forgive you.
If you ask their mercy, why yeah. not? If you ask them to excuse you, they would do, because they're human, they might do that too.
You've had some good experiences with people.
Yes, I am.
Alhamdulillah. Okay, so that's insulting people. What about other mistakes? Sometimes when you make a mistake,
yes.
You know, it makes you repentant. You know, whether it's a sin or whether it's actually just another kind of mistake, you become...
Oh, what about the bad decisions you make to yourself? I mean, the mistakes you do to your own self. Sometimes we do things that would hurt nobody except us.
Mm.
What about those times? Is it still a sin?
It is still a sin, yeah. A sin is a sin, like whether it's affecting other people or not.
However you put it, it's a sin.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's like, it's one of the most selfish ways to actually think. People think, oh, I'm only harming myself, but actually, no, you're not. Sins will inevitably hurt everybody around you. And the most obvious example of that is suicide, right?
Yes.
Suicide,
yes.
People think, oh, okay, yeah, I'm only harming myself, therefore I have the right to do it. And they don't even give a thought about their mother or their wife
parents,
or their husband,
yes,
you know,
siblings,
their parents.
And every
siblings,
single person who they
the
are
friends
responsible
who
for.
Knew them, you know. That's why yeah. when somebody approaches somebody who's about to commit suicide, they tell them, think about your friends. What is your mom going to say? What
exactly,
is your,
about their feelings.
You know, what are your children going to think? You know, you're going to break their hearts and,
yes.
you know, those kind of things. That's an extreme example, and it's an obvious example,
mm-hmm.
but other sins also, like for example, listening to music. I'm listening to haram music because there's lots of halal music, alhamdulillah,
yeah.
lots of halal alternatives to ghina is actually the haram music,
yes.
but you're listening to it, you're like, I'm only harming myself. Oh, you know, if Allah's going to punish me, it's only going to be me, I'm not harming. Actually, no, you're still
alone.
Harming other people,
yes.
you just don't realize the psychological effects that it's
exactly.
had on you, and because of those psychological effects, you know, you're going to have an impact on your friends and
yes,
family.
Yes, based on that music, maybe you get depressed, and that depression is going to affect other people around you.
Drugs,
so there is
same
no
thing.
Personal
right, yeah.
sin.
Yeah, yeah.
All the sins affect other people in your circle.
And by the way, I've never had this thought. You just awakened this thought in me. That is the magic of Youth Station, guys.
Mm-hmm, yes.
It just
everything happens on the spot.
But you're right. In that sense, there really is no personal sin. If
yes.
anything, you're offending the angels who are sitting on your shoulders. You know,
yes,
they're
yes.
having to write this crap down, you know, because
yes.
of you. They want to be writing down good things.
Yes, they have to write good things.
Yeah.
They expect us to let them write good things.
Yeah, yeah. So you, at the very least, you're offending
Why
them.
Do we not learn from our mistakes? Why we do
I
them
told
again
you at the
and again
sister,
and again?
We are stupid. We're really unintellectual beings. Do you know... I've heard somewhere that the definition of insanity is to do the same thing over and over again, and to, even if it fails, it's like running into a wall and then you hurt yourself and then you run into it again and again and again, hoping to get through the wall.
Isn't there any desire inside of us that pushes us into doing those mistakes?
Absolutely.
So it's something intuitively put into us.
Yes and no.
So it's a part of us.
Okay, so in Islamic philosophy, they talk about, or philosophy akhlaq, actually. So yes. That would be ethics, right? So they talk about the four faculties, which I'm sure you've heard of, right? The first is the intellect.
Yeah.
Right? The second is the wahm, the imagination.
Yeah.
The third is the faculty of anger. And the fourth is the faculty of shahwa, desire, right?
Yes.
Now, these four faculties are actually parts of our soul,
yes.
Right? And at one point, you know, intellect will be governing what you do. At another point, anger will come into your mind and it will control what you do. Another time, you know, shahwa will come into your mind. And
so you must practice taqwa. That's the only way to control all of those faculties.
Yeah, and do you know how we define that? It's when the intellect is in control of the other three faculties.
That's very true.
So Imam Khomeini talks about the battle within. You know,
yes, the battle within.
You've read 40 hadith? It's worth reading parts
yes,
of it.
Yes,
least.
It is.
So the very first chapter, he talks about, you know, the whole hadith about the greater jihad?
Yes, jihad with yourself.
Exactly. And he says that it's really fascinating the way he describes it, because he says that there are kind of two armies which are coming to clash with each other, and
yes.
That's happening within you.
Yes, that happens.
So one of the armies is the army of the intellect, right? And it is fighting with the others, and the other, you know, you have the army of shahwa, of desire, of anger, and of the waham, imagination, and they're all
and
battling.
It depends on you which
yeah.
to be armed more.
Yeah, exactly. You have to ensure that the intellect takes control of your entire existence.
Yes, yes, that's very true. Everything starts when the intellect is not working. And we give the control to all the other faculties
yeah.
that you already talked
so,
about.
So let's say, for example, you have a burger in front of you, right? You know that
yes.
this burger is bad for you. Or you know that this burger is haram. Your faculty of desire is going to tell you to eat that burger. But that's your intellect speaking, sister. Actually, if your shahwa was in control,
yes.
if they are, you would be like, this is food and it tastes good. That's it. I'm going to eat it. You see?
Maybe you're right.
Of course. That's what would happen. If the faculty of intelligence doesn't have
yes.
control, the shahwa will drive us to become asfal asafilin.
Yes, that's
it. It will
true.
Make us the lowest of the low.
Yes.
And, you know, there are lots of people in the world today
We'd
who
be
are.
Like the beast.
We would be worse than the beast, yeah.
Yes, like a real
We'd
monster.
Absolutely worse than the beast. But that's what I really do feel like it comes down to. We, although we've been given intellect,
yes.
we don't act upon it.
Maybe we don't appreciate what we have. We don't give it a time to speak of its own right
mm-hmm.
and do whatever it has supposed to do. That's when we are doing those mistakes.
This is IRIB English Radio. You are listening to Youth Station.
There are certain mistakes that you might be making over and over
yes.
again. It's like I'm talking to you like a psychologist right now or like a psychiatrist.
yeah.
Why are you doing this? Why are you doing this insane behavior?
Maybe giving up. You are hoping that maybe something good would come out of it. You're still not done with that situation. You are hopeful. You think there might be some good results the way you have planned in your brain or mind. Maybe you still think there's something good coming out of that mistake that you're going to do on and on. You're still not done.
Wow.
You have not learned the lesson you have to learn. So you do that mistake again and again and again.
That's really sad, isn't it?
It is. Life is tragic.
Life is tragic.
Wow. Yes, life is very tragic.
That should be a quote.
Every
yeah.
single human being is a hero of their own story.
Youth Station, Choo Choo Ka-choo, life is tragic. That's how we should start.
yes.
Life is tragic. Get over it. Well, actually, we make it tragic, though, don't we? Because we just keep on committing those same mistakes.
Well,
and I think you
we're like the fingerprints. Everyone is different.
Mm.
We are not. No way. There is no two people who are going to be the same, who are going to act like the same way. And that's the beauty of human beings, I think, because they're not like each other. Even their mistakes are not going to be like each other.
Yeah.
There's always innovation in doing those mistakes. Everyone does it in their own way.
Yeah. Okay, so then I think you hit the nail on the head when you said that you feel like there's still some benefit in it.
Yes.
And it goes back to the analogy, you know, you're just running into this wall, banging into the wall. You're not thinking of climbing over it or going around it or digging under it or anything. Just keep on banging into it.
And I just remembered something right now. Mm. You know, it's exactly the situation when we are asking God to forgive us about a sin we have done. He says that forgiveness is not given to you unless you are so sad with what have you done. Yeah. Unless you are totally regretful about what you have done. Only in that moment your sin is going to be forgiven.
Yeah.
Because you have come to the conclusion that there is no benefit in that. There is nothing good or no blessing coming out of that mistake you're doing.
Yeah, there's actually no benefit in it for me.
Yes, but you should come into that conclusion like a real
more accurately,
regression.
The benefits in that thing that I'm doing are way, way less than the detriment.
Yes.
Like it has way more harm than good.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay, so people fall into this pattern. You run into the wall, you hit your head, you get pain, you fall down, you get back up, you run into the wall again. And
yes.
It just goes on and on and on.
Like a circle.
How do you break that circle? How do you come out of that mind?
I told you must come to the conclusion that what I'm doing is wrong. Like a real, real conclusion. You have to come to this very point that, okay, I'm fed up with what I'm doing. That's enough. I have to take an action. I have to hang on, think, and act wisely. Stop doing the same thing that is harming me for a very long time. And start doing things in a way that is more satisfactory, that is going to make God happier with me.
Mm-hmm.
Always consider the fact that God is watching us. If we consider that, and based on our fitrat, I think we have to do the right things, and we all know what is the right thing, but we just don't give it a voice to speak louder.
We've only scratched the surface of the subject, but we've run out of time. From myself and from Sister Asma,
yes,
we bid you assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Have good days and nights.
The findings from a pilot study involving 36 patients raised the possibility that COVID may cause microscopic damage to the lungs that is not detected using routine tests. We have prepared for you an article written jointly by Hannah Devlin and Nicola Davis. The piece is titled Long COVID Study Finds Abnormality in Lungs That Could Explain Breathlessness. Abnormalities have been identified in the lungs of long COVID patients that could offer a potential explanation for why some people experience breathlessness long after their initial infection. The findings from a pilot study involving 36 patients raised the possibility that COVID may cause microscopic damage to the lungs that is not detected using routine tests. Breathlessness is a symptom in the majority of long COVID patients, but it has been unclear whether this is linked to other factors such as changes in breathing patterns, tiredness, or something more fundamental. According to Dr. Emily Fraser, a consultant at Oxford University Hospital and a co-author of the study, the latest findings are the first evidence that underlying lung health could be impaired. Dr. Emily Fraser said, "It is the first study to demonstrate lung abnormalities in people with long COVID, who are breathless, and where other investigations are unremarkable. It does suggest the virus is causing some kind of persistent abnormality within the microstructure of the lungs or in the pulmonary vasculature. She added more work would be required to clarify the clinical significance of the findings, including how the apparent abnormalities relate to breathlessness. Claire Steeves, a clinical senior lecturer at King's College London who was not involved in the study, said the findings would be of significant interest to anyone living with long-term breathlessness after COVID. She said they suggest that the efficiency of the lung in doing what it is meant to do, exchange carbon dioxide and oxygen, may be compromised, even though the structure of the lung appears normal. Adding, however, we really need to await the completion of the study to know whether these early findings are robust, and if so, how much they explain and what the ramifications are in terms of potential treatments. Emily Fraser and her colleagues are the latest group to highlight physiological differences seen in people with long COVID, with research published recently pointing to an antibody signature that could help identify those most at risk. The latest study, which is aiming to recruit 400 participants, is using a specialized magnetic resonance imaging technique in which patients breathe in xenon gas while lying in a scanner. The gas can be traced as it moves from the lungs into the bloodstream, giving a reading of how the lungs are functioning. This contrasts with CT scans, which show just the structure of the lungs. The pilot compared three groups: patients diagnosed with long COVID who have normal CT scans, people who had been hospitalized with COVID more than 3 months previously and were not experiencing long COVID, and a healthy control group. The initial results published on the BioRxiv preprint server show there is significantly impaired gas transfer from the lungs to the bloodstream in these long COVID patients, even when other tests are normal. Similar abnormalities have been detected in COVID patients who had been hospitalized with more severe disease. Professor Fergus Gleeson, a radiologist at Oxford University Hospital NHS Foundation Trust and the study's chief investigator, said, "These patients have never been in hospital and did not have an acute severe illness when they had their COVID-19 infection. Some of them have been experiencing their symptoms for a year after contracting COVID-19. Professor Fergus Gleeson said the team were now hoping to look at what proportion of patients with long COVID have abnormal scans and determine the significance of the abnormality and whether it improves over time. Dr. Emily Fraser said the findings did not undermine the relevance of rehabilitation programs, such as breathing retraining for those with disordered patterns of breathing, for instance. She said, "Rehabilitation strategies are really helpful. We can make progress and set people on the right track, so people shouldn't think I've got lung damage and so there's no point." Dr. Louise Siegfried, a public health specialist at the University of Oxford who was not involved in the research, said the findings highlighted the need for those who had continuing symptoms to be given comprehensive diagnostic assessments. She said, "These early findings are really interesting and in line with other emerging data on lung perfusion defects post SARS-CoV-2 infection seen in adults as well as adolescents. Furthermore, research by the UK's Office for National Statistics suggests vaccination could reduce the risk of long COVID. The study of more than 6,000 adults found those who were double vaccinated had a 41% lower likelihood of self-reporting COVID symptoms 12 weeks after first testing positive. Overall, 9.5% of the double vaccinated group reported experiencing long COVID, defined as symptoms lasting more than 4 weeks, compared with 14.6% of a socio-demographically matched group who were unvaccinated. Dr. David Strain, a clinical senior lecturer at the University of Exeter Medical School and the British Medical Association's lead on long COVID, said the Office of National Statistics findings fitted with research published recently that showed low levels of certain antibodies were more common in those who developed long COVID than in patients who swiftly recovered. He said, "We know that the vaccines trigger these immune responses," adding, "If you approach a COVID infection with high levels of these immunoglobulins, it's less likely to become long COVID." Dr. David Strain noted that it was reassuring that vaccination appeared to mitigate the risk of long COVID. A limitation of the study was that because of the timing of the vaccination program, the double vaccinated participants were sampled at a later time point, 238 days on average, than those in the unvaccinated group. So changes in dominant COVID variants in circulation and other factors that varied over the course of the pandemic could have influenced the results. Study was also observational, and while the two groups were matched for age and other socioeconomic factors, there may have been other differences between the groups, meaning the study could not conclusively prove that vaccination caused the different rates of illness. Separately, the Office of National Statistics found that differences in death rates between people from different ethnic backgrounds have persisted since the start of the vaccination program, with the rate of death involving COVID highest for the Bangladeshi group, 5 times greater than white British group for males, 4.5 times greater for females, followed by the Pakistani group, 3.1 times for males and 2.6 times for females, and black Africans, 2.4 times for males and 1.7 times for females. In most cases, the different rates were explained by where people live, social disadvantage, occupation, overall health, and vaccination status. However, the Bangladeshi group and Pakistani men remained at higher risk than average even after adjusting for these factors. Previous research highlighted a gene more common in South Asian populations that could place this group at higher risk from COVID. Vahe Nafilyan of the Office of National Statistics said, "Today's analysis shows that since the vaccination program began, the risk of COVID-19 death has continued to be higher in most ethnic minority groups than in the white British group. For the first time, we show that the lower vaccination coverage in some ethnic groups also contributes to the elevated risk of COVID-19 death, particularly in the black African and black Caribbean groups." The latest data from the Office of National Statistics, based on swabs collected from randomly selected households, suggests that COVID infection levels fell in England, also in Wales and Scotland recently, although the trend was unclear in Northern Ireland. The estimate suggests about 2,629,000 people, or about 1 in 20 in England, had COVID in the week ending 22nd of January. The study also shows that while infection levels are falling in most age groups, they are rising in school-age children. Similar findings have been reported in other research, including the REACT-1 study, the latest results of which were released recently by Imperial College London. According to the Office of National Statistics figures for the week ending 22nd of January, the percentage of those testing positive for COVID increased in England among children between the ages of 2 and 6, as well as for those in school year 7 to 11. With almost 12% of the former and more than 6% of the latter testing positive. While some scientists have called for renewed efforts to vaccinate adolescents and expand the program to all children aged 5 and over, others have emphasized that COVID is generally a mild infection for the age group and that there is a tight risk-benefit involved.
What about you? IRIB English Radio.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, methods of training children. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the methods of training children in the Islamic lifestyle. What we can summarize from the Islamic teachings is that there are three main methods when we are training our children or we are raising our children. And we should adopt these three methods. The first method that we have is to create a habit in the children. It is very important that when we talk about the ethics, when we talk about an Islamic house or an Islamic environment, when we talk about the spirituality in the children, therefore, if they have a specific habit, if we can create a habit of doing a specific thing which is related to their spirituality, which is related to the ethical issues, which is related to their personality, which is related to the Islamic environment which we want to have in the house, this will help them and it will help us as well to have a better environment in the house. This will make them a good person. So this is important that we need to create a good habit in them, and we need to create different habits in them so that when they're used to with it, they can just do it, they can just perform it, they can just practice it even without thinking about it. And this is what we need to do. So therefore, we need to have a list of different habits so which we want in our children when we are training them. And once we are teaching them, training them, and we are emphasizing on these habits will, with the passage of time, become their routine life activities. And inshallah, they can follow these habits. Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the topic of methods of training children. And in this topic, we covered the first method, which is create a habit. Now, let me just give an example. And the example is, let's take an example of a mother who wears a hijab or who observes the hijab or she wears the veil. If she give this habit or if she can create this habit of wearing the hijab every time when she's going out of the house, and obviously for the daughters, the mothers are the role model, and for the boys, the fathers are the role model. So when mother is wearing the hijab and she has made some hijab for the daughter as well, therefore, when this daughter will go outside, she will see her the way her mother is. And this is something good for her, obviously. It gives her a good feeling that she looks like her mother. And from the very little age, when this girl is having the habit of rearing the whale, when she's grown up, she will not leave this habit. Leaving this habit will be something difficult for her, and therefore she will think about leaving this thing. Therefore, we need to train our kids in a way so that we can create some habits in them. And this is the first method of training our children in a way so that they can be raised up according to the Islamic teachings, inshallah. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thanks for listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/EN Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
The limelight.
The regimes that cry that they kill innocents by accident or unintentionally or because the terrorist shield behind them are also the ones that keep killing innocents, says Jonathan Cook, writer in an article titled Honest Mistakes: How U.S. and Israeli Regime Justify Targeting and Killing Civilians. Stay tuned for more. A supposedly independent Pentagon inquiry this month claimed just such a good faith mistake after U.S. commanders authorized a drone strike in late August that killed an Afghan family, including 7 children. A U.S. Air Force general concluded that there was no negligence or misconduct and that no disciplinary action should be taken. At the weekend, the Pentagon exonerated itself again. It called the 2019 airstrike on Baghouz in Syria that killed dozens of women and children justified. It did so even after an investigation by the New York Times showed that the group of civilians who were bombed had already been identified as fleeing fighting between U.S.-backed militias and Daesh. A U.S. military lawyer, Dean Corsack, flagged the incident at the time as a potential war crime, but the Pentagon never carried out an investigation. It came to public attention only because Corsack sent details to a Senate Oversight Committee. In announcing the conclusions of its Afghanistan inquiry, the Pentagon made clear what its true priorities are in the wake of its horrid Saigon-style exit from Afghanistan following 2 decades of failed occupation. It cares about image management, not accountability. Contrast its refusal to take action against the drone operators and commanders who fired on a civilian vehicle with the Pentagon's immediate crackdown on one of its troops who criticized the handling of the withdrawal. Veteran Marine Stuart Scheller was court-martialed last month after he used social media to publicly berate his bosses. Which of the two, Scheller's comment or the impunity of those who killed an innocent family, is likely to do more to discredit the role of the U.S. military in Afghanistan or other theaters around the globe in which it operates? The Pentagon is far from a one in expecting to be exempt from scrutiny for its war crimes. The honest mistake is a continuing colonial narrative Western nations tell themselves and the rest of us when they kill civilians. When Western troops invade and occupy other people's lands and maybe help themselves to some of their resources, they find along the way it is done in the name of bringing security or spreading democracy. We're always the good guys, they are the evil ones. We make mistakes, they commit crimes. This is self-righteousness, is the source of Western indignation at any suggestion that the International Criminal Court at The Hague should investigate, let alone prosecute U.S., European, and Israeli regime commanders or politicians for carrying out or overseeing war crimes. The drone operators who killed the family of Zimari Ahmadi, an employee of a U.S. aid organization, were authorized to do so because his white Toyota Corolla was mistaken for a similar vehicle reported as belonging to the local franchise of Daesh. But that make is one of the most common vehicles in Afghanistan. The head of the aid organization where he worked told reporters pointedly, "I do not understand how the most powerful military in the world could follow Mr. Ahmadi, an aid worker, in a commonly used car for 8 hours and not figure out who he was and why he was at a U.S. aid organization's headquarters." The decision was at best recklessly indifferent as to whether Ahmadi was a genuine target and whether children would die as a result. But more likely, when it attacked Ahmadi's vehicle, the entire U.S. military system was in the grip of a blinding thirst for revenge. 3 days earlier, 13 American troops and 169 Afghan civilians had been killed when a bomb exploded close to Kabul airport as Afghans master in the hope of gaining a place on one of the last evacuation flights. Airport explosion was the final military humiliation, this one inflicted by Daesh, after the Taliban effectively chased American troops out of Afghanistan. Revenge, even when it is dressed up as restoring deterrence or military honor, is not an honest mistake. But there is an even deeper reason to be skeptical of the Pentagon inquiry. There is no honest mistake defense when the same mistakes keep happening. Honest mistakes can't be a pattern of behavior. And yet the long years of U.S. occupation of Afghanistan and Iraq and meddling in Syria have been pockmarked with airstrikes that obliterated families or slammed into wedding parties. That information rarely makes headlines, eclipsed by the Pentagon's earlier faulty claims of successful neutralization of terrorists. But just such mistakes were the reason why the U.S. occupation of Afghanistan ultimately imploded. The Pentagon's scattergun killing of Afghans created so many enemies among the local population that U.S.-backed local rulers lost all legitimacy. Something similar happened during the U.S. and U.K.'s occupation of Iraq. Anyone who believes the Pentagon commits honest mistakes when it kills civilians needs to watch the video Collateral Murder issued by WikiLeaks in 2012. It shows the aerial view of helicopter pilots in 2007 as they discuss with a mix of technical indifference and gruesome glee their missile strikes on a crowd of Iraqis, including two Reuters journalists, moving about on the streets of Baghdad below. When a passing van tries to come to the aid of one of the wounded, the pilots fire again, even though a child is visible in the front seat. In fact, two children were found inside the van. U.S. troops arriving at the scene made the decision to deny both treatment from U.S. physicians. As the pilots were told of the casualties, one commented, "Well, it's their fault for bringing their kids into a battle." The other responded, "That's right." Before the video was leaked, the military claimed that civilians killed that day had been caught in the crossfire of a gun battle. There is no question that coalition forces were clearly engaged in combat operations against a hostile force, a statement read. The video, however, shows that there was nothing honest or mistaken about the way those Iraqis died, even if there was no specific intention to kill civilians. They were killed because U.S. commanders were uninterested in the safety of those it occupied, because they were indifferent to whether Iraqis, even Iraqi children, lived or died. The regimes that cry loudest that they kill innocents by accident or unintentionally or because the terrorist shield behind them are also the ones that keep killing innocents. The Israeli regime's version of this is the tragic mistake. The excuse is used in 2014 when its navy fired two precision missiles at a beach in Gaza at exactly the spot where four boys were playing football. They were killed instantly. In 7 weeks of pummeling Gaza in 2014, the Israeli regime killed more than 500 Palestinian children and more than 850 adult civilians. And yet all were apparently honest mistakes, because no troops, commanders, or politicians were ever held to account for those deaths. Palestinian civilians keep dying year after year, decade after decade, and yet they are always killed by an honest mistake. The Israeli regime's excuses are entirely unconvincing for the same reason the Pentagon's carry no weight. Both have committed their crimes in another people's territory to which they have not been invited. Both militaries rule over those people without good cause, treating the local population as hostiles, and both act in knowledge that their troops enjoy absolute impunity. In reaching its decision on the killing of the Afghan family this month, the Pentagon stated that it had not broken the law. That verdict, too, is not honest. What the U.S. military means is that it did not break its own self-serving rules of engagement, rules that permit anything the U.S. military decides it wants to do. It behaves if no law applies to it when it invades other lands, not even the laws of territories it occupies. That argument is dishonest, too. There are the laws of war and the laws of occupation. There is international law. The U.S. has broken those laws over and over again in Afghanistan and Iraq, as has the Zionist regime, in ruling over the Palestinians for more than five decades and blockading parts of their territory. The problem is that there is no appetite to enforce international law against the planet's sole military superpower and its allies. Instead, it is allowed to claim the role of benevolent global policeman. Both the U.S. and the Israeli regime declined to ratify the Rome Statute, which established the International Criminal Court, ICC, that judges war crimes. That refusal was no honest mistake either. Each expected to avoid the court's scrutiny. U.S. and Israeli regime leaders know their troops commit war crimes, and that they themselves commit war crimes by approving either the wars of aggression these troops are expected to wage or the messy, long-term, belligerent occupations they are supposed to enforce. But whatever they hope, the failure to ratify the statute does not serve as a stay-out-of-jail card. U.S. and Israeli regime leaders still risk falling under the ICC's jurisdiction if the countries they invade or occupy have ratified the statute, as is the case with Afghanistan and Palestine. The catch is that the Hague Court can be used only as a last resort. In other words, it has to be shown first that any country accused of war crimes failed to seriously investigate those crimes itself. The chorus from the U.S. and Israeli regime of honest mistake every time they kill civilians is just such proof. It demonstrates that the U.S. and Israeli regime systems are entirely incapable of upholding laws of war or holding their own political and military officials to account. That must be the job of ICC instead. But the court is fearful. The Trump administration launched the war against it last year to stop its officials investigating U.S. war crimes in Afghanistan. The assets of the court's officials were blocked and they were denied the right to enter the U.S. That is the reason why the court keeps failing to stand up for the victims of Western war crimes like Zimari Ahmadi and his children. The ICC had spent 15 years dragging its feet before it finally announced last year that it would investigate allegations of U.S. war crimes in Afghanistan. That resolve quickly dissolved under the subsequent campaign of pressure. In September, shortly after Ahmadi's family was killed by U.S. drone operators, the court's chief prosecutor declared that investigations into U.S. actions in Afghanistan, including widespread claims of torture of Afghans, would be deprioritized. The investigation would focus instead on Taliban and Daesh. Once again, enemies of the United States, but not the United States itself, will be called to account. That, too, is no honest mistake.
Diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Enmity of arrogant powers towards Iran originates from Leather's anti-arrogance and colonialist spirit. This is the part of a televised speech delivered on January 9, 2022, by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, on the anniversary of an uprising by the people of Qom on January 9, 1978.
Fortunately, today, the thoughts and ideas of the pious, dedicated youth are wide-ranging. Fortunately, today we are witness to revolutionary, religious, blossoming, progressive ideas presented by a large number of the youth. On this basis, I wish to raise a number of points. There are many points to be raised, but one cannot speak at length about these points in these meetings, so I will only mention several of them. The first point is that, my dear ones, who hear these sentiments from this humble person, you should preserve religious zeal. You must preserve it. The factor that has saved the country in different times has been the religious zeal of the Iranian nation. It is religious zeal that turns threats into opportunities. An example of this was the imposed war, the 8-year sacred defense, which presented a great threat. But the religious zeal of the people, the religious zeal of the youth, the religious zeal of the fathers and mothers and wives caused our youth to go to the front lines. In that war that was truly global and in which the US, the Soviet Union, NATO and the reactionary forces in the region
those days had all joined hands to defeat Iran, bring Imam to his knees and annihilate the movement. It was religious zeal that defeated all of them. This achievement had its base in religious zeal. This was about the role of religious zeal during the sacred defense, but there were other events in subsequent years as well.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
In our own time, we can mention the martyrdom of our dear martyr, Martyr Soleimani. The martyrdom of Shahid Soleimani truly turned into a historic, astonishing event. No one thought that tragedy would achieve such greatness and that God, the Exalted, would bless it in such a manner that it would be able to show the religious and revolutionary identity of the people to everyone in the world. The Iranian nation showed its identity and unity in the true sense of the word when they were carrying the coffin of Shahid Soleimani. Well, funerals were held for him in Tehran, in Kerman, in Tabriz, Mashhad, and various other cities in Iran. An enormous funeral was held for him in Iraq too. If that martyr's holy body had been taken to Syria and Lebanon, the same things would have happened there as well.
Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done.
Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Islamic and national forces in the Gaza Strip held a rally near the separation fence between Gaza and the occupied lands. The rally comes to voice the Palestinian outrage of the Israeli apartheid policies of land grabbing. And Naqab is witnessing a wave of forced displacement by Israel's system of apartheid against all Palestinians. Considering these Israeli attempts to expel thousands of Palestinians from their homes and lands, a crime against humanity, Palestinians in the Gaza Strip expressed their support to Palestinians in Al-Naqab, south of the country.
The Israeli regime has stolen our land since 1948. Until this moment, it keeps practicing apartheid attempts to take our lands by force. My words for Palestinians in Al-Naqab is that we will always be supported and we are all united in the face of this aggression.
In their speeches, Palestinian factions stressed that the issue of Al-Naqab is the issue of every Palestinian and they won't sit idle in the face of these illegal crimes.
This event is organized by the national and the Islamic forces in Gaza and all the Palestinian tribesmen in order to express our support to our people in Al-Naqab, who are under the Israeli apartheid policies of land grabbing. Israel wants to expel those people from their lands and homes, and this is unacceptable for us. We are together until breaking the Zionist Bennett, who threatened to build an iron wall around our people in Al-Nakab.
Calling it an ongoing Nakba, hundreds of Palestinian citizens demonstrated in Al-Nakab while dozens of them were arrested by the Israeli regime. The number of Arab citizens in Al-Nakab is estimated at 300,000, living on 5% of the land, of which they said that Israel had confiscated 95% since 1948. Al-Nakab has seen a dramatic escalation as the Israeli regime intensifies its apartheid policies of seizing the Palestinian lands. Palestinians here stress that Al-Nakab is not alone in this struggle. They also say they won't remain silent in this battle against the Israeli crimes. Ruba Shavit, Gaza.
Mattarella. Mattarella.
After 6 days of failed votes and 8 rounds of ballots, on Saturday the Italian parliament re-elected 80-year-old Sergio Mattarella as president of the republic with 759 votes out of 983 cast by the grand electors. In the days ahead of the election, Mattarella, who has been in office since 2015, had repeatedly said that he didn't want another stint. However, he changed his mind on Saturday afternoon when the leaders of parliamentary groups resorted to him in a desperate attempt to put an end to a political impasse that would erode the nation's credibility. The political stalemate was triggered by parties' disagreement over the candidacy of Prime Minister Draghi to be the next president earlier in the week. In the following days, parties struggled to reach an agreement over an alternative figure, dragging the country on the verge of a political crisis. Commentators have slammed political leaders for their bickering over a consensus candidate. Some have said that not even during a pandemic crisis which has brought the country to its knees, political parties have been able to put aside their differences. Prime Minister Draghi is expected to reshuffle his cabinet as his first move following Mattarella's election. He has to make sure that the 260 billion euros that Italy is receiving from the European Recovery Fund to counter the economic fallout of the COVID-19 crisis are spent effectively. Draghi has committed to 58 reforms and 132 investments over the next 5 years. Max Civili, Rome.
Cheering for Syrian President Bashar al-Assad, thousands of locals in southern Damascus welcomed high-ranking security officers who arrived in Kiswe town to initiate a reconciliation process that would lead to providing amnesty to those wanted by security apparatus during the crisis and implementation of presidential amnesty decrees.
There is an amnesty decree by President Bashar al-Assad today to start a reconciliation campaign in the countryside. Tomorrow, the campaign will cover all Damascus countryside for all misled Syrians. The importance of such a campaign is its contribution in restoring peace.
We conveyed the demands of the people in Damascus countryside for reconciliation to President Assad, who ordered the formation of a security committee that includes the military prosecution and all security apparatus to solve the problems of the people and settle their situation.
Hundreds of wanted people flocked to reconciliation centers to settle their situation. Some had escaped military duty, while others were involved in anti-government acts or were members of armed groups in the past.
We were outlaws. We came to reconcile. We were misled like many Syrians. Everyone makes mistakes. We came today to be on the right track with our homeland thanks to President Assad.
This is the most comprehensive reconciliation deal south of the capital. Over 2,700 individuals had reconciled in southern Damascus since 2016. Thousands more currently have the chance to return to normal life in the next week. The Syrian government has for years prioritized reconciliation deals over military solutions in areas that have witnessed violence throughout the unrest. Such deals lay the foundation for negotiated settlement of the crisis facing the country. Hamad Ali, Damascus Countryside.
People in the blockaded Gaza Strip held a sit-in in solidarity with Palestinians in the Negev. The event was held in the east of Gaza by Palestinian resistance factions. In recent days, the Israeli regime launched violent attacks in the Negev to ev- restrict Palestinians from their villages. Palestinians view Israeli attacks in the Negev as a continuation of the 1948 Nakba, when Palestinians were forcibly displaced from their homes during the creation of the Israeli regime.
This criminal entity will never succeed in stealing our land. Destroying the villages will not break the will of our people in the Negev. As we stand here, we say to the enemy,